Chapter 3 Mount Doom. Sam put his ragged orc cloak under his master's head, and covered them both with the grey robe of Lorien, and as he did so his thoughts went out to that fair land, and to the elves, and he hoped that the cloth woven by their hands might have some virtue to keep them hidden beyond all hope in this wilderness of fear. He heard the scuffling and cries die down as the troops passed on through the Eisenmouth. It seemed that in the confusion and the mingling of many companies of various kinds they had not been missed, not yet at any rate. Sam took a sip of water, but pressed Frodo to drink, and when his master had recovered a little, he gave him a whole wafer of their precious whey-bread and made him eat it. Then, too worn out even to feel much fear, they stretched themselves out. They slept a little in uneasy fits, for their sweat grew chill on them, and the hard stones bit them, and they shivered. Out of the north from the Black Gate through Kirith Gorgor there flowed, whispering along the road, a thin, cold air. In the morning a grey light came again, for in the high regions the west wind still blew. But down on the stones behind the fences of the Black Land the air seemed almost dead, chill and yet stifling. Sam looked up out of the hollow. The land all about was dreary, flat and drab-hued. On the roads nearby nothing was moving now, but Sam feared the watchful eyes on the walls of the Eisenmouth, no more than a furlong away northward. South-eastward, far off like a dark standing shadow, loomed the mountain. Smokes were pouring from it, and while those that rose into the upper air trailed away eastward, great rolling clouds floated down its sides and spread over the land. A few miles to the northeast, the foothills of the Ashen Mountains stood like sombre grey ghosts, behind which the misty northern heights rose like a line of distant cloud, hardly darker than the lowering sky. Sam tried to guess the distances, and to decide what way they ought to take. "It looks every step of 50 miles," he muttered gloomily, staring at the threatening mountain, "and that'll take a week if it takes a day with Mr. Frodo as he is." He shook his head, and as he worked things out, slowly a new dark thought grew in his mind. Never for long had hope died in his staunch heart, and always until now he had taken some thought for their return. But the bitter truth came home to him at last. At best their provision would take them to their goal, and when the task was done, there they would come to an end, alone, houseless, foodless, in the midst of a terrible desert. There could be no return. "So that was the job I felt I had to do when I started," thought Sam. "To help Mr. Frodo to the last step and then die with him? Well, if that is the job, then I must do it. But I would dearly like to see Bywater again, and Rosie Cotton and her brothers, and the Gaffer and Marigold and all. I can't think somehow that Gandalf would have sent Mr. Frodo on this errand if there hadn't been any hope of his ever coming back at all. Things all went wrong when he went down in Moria. I wish he hadn't. He would have done something." But even as hope died in Sam, or seemed to die, it was turned to a new strength. Sam's plain hobbit face grew stern, almost grim, as the will hardened in him, and he felt through all his limbs a thrill, as if he was turning into some creature of stone and steel that neither despair nor weariness nor endless barren miles could subdue. With a new sense of responsibility, he brought his eyes back to the ground near at hand, studying the next move. As the light grew a little, he saw to his surprise that what from a distance had seemed wide and featureless flats were in fact all broken and tumbled. Indeed, the whole surface of the plains of Gorgoroth was pocked with great holes, as if, while it was still a waste of soft mud, it had been smitten with a shower of bolts and huge slingstones. The largest of these holes were rimmed with ridges of broken rock, and broad fissures ran out from them in all directions. It was a land in which it would be possible to creep from hiding to hiding, unseen by all but the most watchful eyes. Possible at least for one who was strong and had no need for speed. For the hungry and worn, who had far to go before life failed, it had an evil look. Thinking of all these things, Sam went back to his master. He had no need to rouse him. Frodo was lying on his back with eyes open, staring at the cloudy sky. "Well, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, "I've been having a look round and thinking a bit. There is nothing on the roads, and we'd best be getting away while there's a chance. Can you manage it?"
"I can manage it," said Frodo. "I must."
Once more they started, crawling from hollow to hollow, flitting behind such cover as they could find, but moving always in a slant towards the foothills of the northern range. But as they went, the most easterly of the roads followed them, until it ran off, hugging the skirts of the mountains, away into a wall of black shadow far ahead. Neither man nor orc now moved along its flat grey stretches, for the Dark Lord had almost completed the movement of his forces, and even in the fastness of his own realm he sought the secrecy of night, fearing the winds of the world that had turned against him, tearing aside his veils, and troubled with tidings of bold spies that had passed through his fences. The hobbits had gone a few weary miles when they halted. Frodo seemed nearly spent. Sam saw that he could not go much further in this fashion, crawling, stooping, now picking a doubtful way very slowly, now hurrying at a stumbling run. "I'm going back onto the road while the light lasts, Mr. Frodo," he said. "Trust to luck again. It nearly failed us last time, but it didn't quite. A steady pace for a few more miles, and then a rest." He was taking a far greater risk than he knew, but Frodo was too much occupied with his burden and with the struggle in his mind to debate, and almost too hopeless to care. They climbed on to the causeway and trudged along, down the hard, cruel road that led to the Dark Tower itself. But their luck held, and for the rest of that day they met no living or moving thing, and when night fell they vanished into the darkness of Mordor. All the land now brooded as at the coming of a great storm, for the captains of the West had passed the crossroads and set flames in the deadly fields of Imlad Morgul. So the desperate journey went on, as the ring went south and the banners of the kings rode north. For the hobbits each day, each mile, was more bitter than the one before, as their strength lessened and the land became more evil. They met no enemies by day. At times by night, as they cowered or drowsed uneasily in some hiding beside the road, they heard cries and the noise of many feet, or the swift passing of some cruelly ridden steed. But far worse than all such perils was the ever-approaching threat that beat upon them as they went, the dreadful menace of the power that waited, brooding in deep thought and sleepless malice, behind the dark veils about its throne. Nearer and nearer it drew, looming blacker, like the oncoming of a wall of night at the last end of the world. There came at last a dreadful nightfall, and even as the captains of the West drew near to the end of their living lands, the two wanderers came to an hour of blank despair. 4 days had passed since they had escaped from the orcs, but the time lay behind them like an ever-darkening dream. All this last day Frodo had not spoken, but had walked half-bowed, often stumbling, as if his eyes no longer saw the way before his feet. Sam guessed that among all their pains he bore the worst, the growing weight of the ring, a burden on the body and a torment to his mind. Anxiously Sam had noted how his master's left hand would often be raised as if to ward off a blow, or to screen his shrinking eyes from a dreadful eye that sought to look in them. And sometimes his right hand would creep to his breast, clutching, and then slowly, As the will recovered mastery, it would be withdrawn. Now, as the blackness of night returned, Frodo sat, his head between his knees, his arms hanging wearily to the ground where his hands lay feebly twitching. Sam watched him, till night covered them both and hid them from one another. He could no longer find any words to say, and he turned to his own dark thoughts. As for himself, though weary and under a shadow of fear, he still had some strength left. The Lembas had a virtue, without which they would long ago have lain down to die. It did not satisfy desire, and at times Sam's mind was filled with the memories of food and the longing for simple bread and meats. And yet this waybread of the elves had a potency that increased as travellers relied on it alone and did not mingle it with other foods. It fed the will, and it gave strength to endure, and to master sinew and limb beyond the measure of mortal kind. But now a new decision must be made. They could not follow this road any longer, for it went on eastward into the great shadow. But the mountain now loomed upon their right, almost due south, and they must turn towards it. Yet still before it there stretched a wide region of fuming, barren, ash-ridden land. "Water! Water!" muttered Sam. He had stinted himself, and in his parched mouth his tongue seemed thick and swollen. But for all his care, they now had very little, perhaps half his bottle, and maybe there were still days to go. All would long ago have been spent, if they had not dared to follow the Ork Road. For at long intervals on that highway, cisterns had been built for the use of troops sent in haste through the waterless regions. In one, Sam had found some water left, stale, muddied by the orks, but still sufficient for their desperate case. Yet that was now a day ago. There was no hope of any more. At last, wearied with his cares, Sam drowsed, leaving the morrow till it came. He could do no more. Dream and waking mingled uneasily. He saw lights like gloating eyes, and dark creeping shapes, and he heard noises as of wild beasts, or the dreadful cries of tortured things, and he would start up to find the world all dark and only empty blackness all about him. Once only, as he stood and stared wildly round, did it seem that, though now awake, he could still see pale lights like eyes, but soon they flickered and vanished. The hateful night passed slowly and reluctantly. Such daylight as followed was dim, for here, as the mountain drew near, the air was ever murky, while out from the dark tower there crept the veils of shadow that Sauron wove about himself. Frodo was lying on his back, not moving. Sam stood beside him, reluctant to speak, and yet knowing that the word now lay with him. He must set his master's will to work for another effort. At length, stooping and caressing Frodo's brow, he spoke in his ear. "Wake up, master," he said. "Time for another start." As if roused by a sudden bell, Frodo rose quickly, and stood up and looked away southwards. But when his eyes beheld the mountain and the desert, he quailed again. "I can't manage it, Sam," he said. "It's such a weight to carry, such a weight." Sam knew before he spoke that it was vain, and that such words might do more harm than good, but in his pity he could not keep silent. "Then let me carry it a bit for you, master," he said. "You know I would, and gladly, as long as I have any strength." A wild light came into Frodo's eyes. "Stand away! Don't touch me!" he cried. "It is mine, I say. Be off!" His hands strayed to his sword-hilt. But then quickly his voice changed. "No, no, Sam," he said sadly. "But you must understand, it is my burden, and no one else can bear it. It's too late now, Sam dear. You can't help me in that way again. I'm almost in its power now. I could not give it up, and if you tried to take it, I should go mad." Sam nodded. "I understand," he said. "But I've been thinking, Mr. Frodo, there's other things we might do without. Why not lighten the load a bit? We're going that way now, as straight as we can make it. He pointed to the mountain. It's no good taking anything we're not sure to need. Frodo looked again towards the mountain. No, he said, we shan't need much on that road, and at its end nothing. Picking up his orc shield, he flung it away and threw his helmet after it. Then, pulling off the grey cloak, he undid the heavy belt and let it fall to the ground, and the sheathed sword with it. The threads of the black cloak he tore off and scattered. "There, I'll be an orc no more," he cried, "and I'll bear no weapon, fair or foul. Let them take me if they will." Sam did likewise, and put aside his orc gear, and he took out all the things in his pack. Somehow each of them had become dear to him, if only because he had borne them so far with so much toil. Hardest of all to part with was his cooking gear. Tears welled in his eyes at the thought of casting it away. "Do you remember that bit of rabbit, Mr. Frodo?" he said. "And our place under the warm bank in Captain Faramir's country, the day I saw an Olifant?" "No, I'm afraid not, Sam," said Frodo. "At least I know that such things happened. But I can't see them. No taste of food, no feel of water, no sound of wind, no memory of tree or grass or flower, no image of moon or star are left to me. I'm naked in the dark, Sam, and there's no veil between me and the wheel of fire. I begin to see it even with my waking eyes, and all else fades." Sam went to him and kissed his hand.
"Then the sooner we're rid of it, the sooner to rest," he said haltingly, finding no better words to say. "Talking won't mend nothing," he muttered to himself, as he gathered up all the things that they had chosen to cast away. He was not willing to leave them lying open in the wilderness for any eyes to see. "Stinker picked up that orc shirt, seemingly, and he isn't going to add a sword to it. His hands are bad enough when empty, and he isn't going to mess with my pans." With that he carried all the gear away to one of the many gaping fissures that scored the land and threw them in. The clatter of his precious pans as they fell down into the dark was like a death knell to his heart. He came back to Frodo, and then, of his elven rope, he cut a short piece to serve his master as a girdle and bind the grey cloak close about his waist. The rest he carefully coiled and put back in his pack. Beside that he kept only the remnants of their whey-bread and the water-bottle, and Sting still hanging by his belt, and hidden away in a pocket of his tunic next his breast, the file of Galadriel, and the little box that she gave him for his own. Now at last they turned their faces to the mountain and set out, thinking no more of concealment, bending their weariness and failing wills only to the one task of going on. In the dimness of its dreary day, few things even in that land of vigilance could have espied them, save from close at hand. Of all the slaves of the Dark Lord, only the Nazgul could have warned him of the peril that crept, small but indomitable, into the very heart of his guarded realm. But the Nazgul and their black wings were abroad on another errand. They were gathered far away, shadowing the march of the captains of the West, and thither the thought of the Dark Tower was turned. That day it seemed to Sam that his master had found some new strength, more than could be explained by the small lightening of the load that he had to carry. In the first marches they went further and faster than he had hoped. The land was rough and hostile, and yet they made much progress, and even the mountain drew nearer. But as the day wore on, and all too soon the dim light began to fail, Frodo stooped again, and began to stagger, as if the renewed effort had squandered his remaining strength. At their last halt he sank down and said, "I'm thirsty, Sam," and didn't speak again. Sam gave him a mouthful of water. Only one more mouthful remained. He went without himself. And now, as once more the night of Mordor closed over him, through all his thoughts there came the memory of water, and every brook or stream or fount that he had ever seen, under green willow shades or twinkling in the sun, danced and rippled for his torment behind the blindness of his eyes. He felt the cool mud about his toes as he paddled in the pool at Bywater with Jolly Cotton and Tom and Nibs and their sister Rosie. But that was years ago, he sighed, and far away. The way back, if there is one, goes past the mountain. He couldn't sleep, and he held a debate with himself. Well, come now. We've done better than you hoped, he said sturdily. Begun well, anyway. I reckon we crossed half the distance before we stopped. One more day will do it. And then he paused. Don't be a fool, Sam Gamgee, came an answer in his own voice. He won't go another day like that if he moves at all, and you can't go on much longer giving him all the water and most of the food. I can go on a good way, though, and I will. Where to? To the mountain, of course. But what then, Sam Gamgee? What then? When you get there, what are you going to do? He won't be able to do anything for himself. To his dismay, Sam realized that he had not got an answer to this. He had no clear idea at all. Frodo had not spoken much to him of his errand, and Sam only knew vaguely that the ring had somehow to be put into the fire. The Cracks of Doom, he muttered, the old name rising to his mind. Well, if Master knows how to find them, I don't. There you are, came the answer. It's all quite useless. He said so himself. You're the fool going on hoping and toiling. You could have lain down and gone to sleep together days ago if you hadn't been so dogged. But you'll die just the same, or worse. You might just as well lie down now and give it up. You'll never get to the top anyway.
I'll get there, if I leave everything but my bones behind, said Sam. And I'll carry Mr. Frodo up myself if it breaks my back and heart. So stop arguing.
At that moment Sam felt a tremor in the ground beneath him, and he heard or sensed a deep remote rumble as of thunder imprisoned under the earth. There was a brief red flame that flickered under the clouds and died away. The mountain, too, slept uneasily. The last stage of their journey to Orodruin came, and it was a torment greater than Sam had ever thought that he could bear. He was in pain, and so parched that he could no longer swallow even a mouthful of food. It remained dark, not only because of the smokes of the mountain. There seemed to be a storm coming up, and away to the southeast there was a shimmer of lightnings under the black skies. Worst of all, the air was full of fumes, breathing was painful and difficult, and a dizziness came on them, so that they staggered and often fell, and yet their wills did not yield, and they struggled on. The mountain crept up ever nearer, until, if they lifted their heavy heads, it filled all their sight, looming vast before them, a huge mass of ash and slag and burned stone, out of which a sheer-sided cone was raised into the clouds. Before the day-long dusk ended and true night came again, they had crawled and stumbled to its very feet. With a gasp, Frodo cast himself on the ground. Sam sat by him. To his surprise, he felt tired but lighter, and his head seemed clear again. No more debates disturbed his mind. He knew all the arguments of despair and would not listen to them. His will was set, and only death would break it. He felt no longer either desire or need of sleep, but rather of watchfulness. He knew that all the hazards and perils were now drawing together to a point. The next day would be a day of doom, the day of final effort or disaster, the last gasp. But when would it come? The night seemed endless and timeless, minute after minute falling dead and adding up to no passing hour, bringing no change. Sam began to wonder if a second darkness had begun, and no day would ever reappear. At last he groped for Frodo's hand. It was cold and trembling. His master was shivering. "I didn't ought to have left my blanket behind," muttered Sam, and lying down he tried to comfort Frodo with his arms and body. Then sleep took him, and the dim light of the last day of their quest found them side by side. The wind had fallen the day before, as it shifted from the west, and now it came from the north, and began to rise. And slowly the light of the unseen sun filtered down into the shadows where the hobbits lay.